From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The way in which we view the world is deeply influenced by earlier generations, yet our cultural views, while constantly in flux, do determine our general relationship to the earth and our environment, and so it's critical. Today, as humanity sits on the brink of climate catastrophe, why is it not entirely obvious to everyone, including those who have the power to change things, that we have to find ways to live sustainably or perish? My guest, Jeremy Lent, author of the new book, The Patterning Instinct, writes, our, quote, obsession with exploiting resources without regard to consequences was unique to the European mindset, which has now become the predominant global mindset. Jeremy Lent is a writer and founder and president of the Leology Institute. His new book is called The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. Welcome to the program, Jeremy.
Thank you, Sonali. A pleasure to be here.
First, explain what the patterning instinct is. What does this term, which sounds a little technical, actually mean?
Yeah, well, it's really the instinct that we humans have more than any other mammal that really is what makes us unique among really all other creatures on the earth. And it's this instinct to pattern meaning into the otherwise kind of random set of sounds and everything that we receive as inputs around us. So, like, imagine a newborn infant and how she learns to speak. She does that because of that patterning instinct. Nobody tells her, you know, you're meant to try to figure out what we're saying and make language out of it. But her instinct is to make sense of all those sort of strange sounds and activities all around her until she picks up language and ultimately her culture. And it's the instinct that when humans first evolved as humans with language a couple of 100,000 years ago, our ancestors looked around at nature and at the sky and at everything that happened around them. And they used that patterning instinct to begin to make some sort of meaning out of the universe, to essentially create stories, to understand essentially what was the meaning of their lives and how that should affect what they do.
So in many ways, this is also probably what leads us humans to create religious beliefs, the idea of God, which, at least as far as we know, other species don't have.
Yes, that is absolutely right. And in fact, one of the things that I do in the book, in this kind of looking at the way humanity's search for meaning from the earliest times, is look at the different ways in which they created these kind of mythic structures, if you will, around the universe that nowadays we call religion. But back in earlier times, they didn't even think of it as religion, but just as the way of making sense. And in a way, the same is true today. Like when the kind of worldviews that a lot of people hold that are dominant today, people wouldn't say are religious per se, and in some cases, but they hold just as much a strong power over driving what people's actions and values are.
So does this include not just us trying to make sense of the universe, but our place in it, what humanity's goal, overall, you know, goal of existence is?
Yes, very much so. And so, you know, at the deepest layers, even if we're not thinking about it all the time, all of us are driven by some of these fundamental questions, like, who am I? What am I? What am I meant to do on this earth, in my life, in my community? And generally, those are kind of answers that our cultures give us as we begin to grow from the first few years of our life. And so a lot of the time, we kind of live our lives according to these core set of values, but without being aware of it. And so part of what I'm trying to do in the book is by looking at the way other cultures have made meaning out of their lives and looking at the way that we do in our dominant culture, help us to really understand and become more conscious of some of the underlying assumptions that we just take for granted.
So let's talk about what we know from human evolution, because this is an important story. People have tried to understand the natural instincts of humans as a whole by looking back at prehistory and seeing how early humans developed. There's competing theories of whether we are a species that thrives on war versus species that thrives on cooperation and peace. And depending upon your political views, you might want to believe one over the other. What does human evolution tell us about the idea of living sustainably? Because that, of course, is a critical call that we must find how to make a cultural shift toward if we are to survive. And we see from many indigenous groups that have roots that go back generations and generations that it is possible for groups of humans to live in concert with the earth rather than at war with the earth.
Right. That's so true. And that's this whole notion of looking through the lens of evolutionary science to determine who we are as humans. It's so fascinating because that's a perfect example of how our patterning instinct works and how we try to sort of pattern meaning into whatever new sort of ways of making sense of things come around us. So a real dominant kind of story that we've heard now for a number of decades in the West and basically in sort of world culture is this notion that humans are fundamentally selfish. We can, ascribe some of that to the success of Richard Dawkins' selfish gene idea, but that's been around for quite a while.
And people ascribe it to Darwin's theory of evolution. Darwinism is basically seen as humanity's natural selfishness, whether or not Darwin actually meant that.
And that's the thing, that Darwin really didn't say that at all, but so many people have been interpreting it now since that time that is actually kind of viewed as this kind of sense of Darwinism in that respect. But what's so fascinating is in recent decades, a whole slew of cognitive anthropologists, evolutionary biologists, and other scientists have looked at the evolution of humans and have seen that what really makes us actually unique, what makes us different from other primates, like chimpanzees, gorillas, orangutans, et cetera, is actually our ability to work together, to have some of these really advanced human kind of emotions, like things like empathy, compassion, altruism. These are things that we do detect in some other social animals, but we humans have that to a very, very large degree. And that's actually some of the core elements that led us to develop ourselves as humans and to develop culture and to be able to do everything that we've done since we evolved. And that leads to a very different story of what it means to be human and what it means to connect with the natural world. Because instead of just focusing on this kind of neoliberal myth that says humans are fundamentally selfish, so the best thing we can do is be in a system that allows us to act selfishly, and then that ends up being for the greater good of everyone. And we can begin to develop a whole different way of looking at economics, looking at society, by saying, actually, it's part of our drives as humans to be in community with people, to care about others.
This what you were just mentioning is essentially the basis of neoliberal capitalism. So staying on prehistory for a little while, or early human history, you point out in your book that there was a difference in the systematic difference between the ways in which hunter-gatherer societies developed versus agrarian societies or agricultural with the agricultural revolution, societies that depended on farming. Why was there a difference? What was the difference? And how does that bear on our struggle to find a sustainable future for humanity?
Yeah, great question. And in some ways, that is probably the single biggest event that happened in human history to change the intrinsic human experience. And as you said, we spent 95% of our of human history as nomadic hunter-gatherers, which means we lived together in relatively small bands and just traveled around. And when you do that, when you live in a nomadic way, possessions really don't mean anything to you. There's a few things you might want to carry around with you. But other than that, you're kind of relying on your community and on the natural world to give what it chooses to give you. And when we first developed agriculture about 12,000 years ago, it created a sense of separation that had never existed before in that human experience. And could imagine once you start settling down and you start working fields, well, you want to put fences up to protect the fields against other animals, also against other human beings. And if you spend your whole life working hard and kind of storing your grains and buying possessions, well, you end up wanting to make sure that you're giving those possessions to your next generation. And before too long, inequalities develop. You also have things like specialization develops, which is what led to civilization to occur, but also led to increasing new values, basically in the human experience, the sense of possessions, material wealth, being something of value rather than something that was basically irrelevant. And along with those things comes the fear of losing them. And so the development of hierarchy and increasing inequalities of power, where powerful people become even more powerful by having other people work for them.
How well do we know this? I mean, it's so tempting to ascribe a sort of romantic worldview to the hunter-gatherer societies, but it also sounds, you know, kind of hard, very, very hard life. We don't know necessarily if those societies were, say, anti-patriarchal, do we? I mean, we don't know necessarily if inequality, do we know if inequalities existed or not in those societies? Are we romanticizing them?
So yeah, it's so interesting. And again, the sort of political lens that people choose to apply really leads to different interpretations of the facts that are there. So, but there are actually from anthropological studies of more recent hunter-gatherers in the last century or so. And
So communities that have remained isolated from the rest of civilization.
Exactly.
In the Amazon, we've had seen several
exactly.
groups like that.
All the way from the Inuit in the Arctic Circle to jungles, etc. And also through archaeology, we've got a pretty good sense of what hunter-gatherer life was like. But there is this sense that there is a risk of glorifying them. And so on the plus side, I think it's absolutely true that nomadic hunter-gatherers had a life of much more egalitarianism. There was really none of the hierarchy that we see right now. At the same time, there's been this cold debate as were they more violent or not? And there are some people who say that wars only really began when agriculture developed. Other people say, well, actually, no, they were just as violent as each other. And the reality is something in between. There was violence, but hunter-gatherer communities developed very sophisticated ways of stopping the sort of big man, if you will, from taking over and creating too much violence. So there'd be a lot of community interaction that would keep this kind of egalitarian space going. And it was really only once civilization developed and larger communities developed, and you had to really defend your property against other people invading. Mm-hmm. That was really when wars actually began in earnest, and you have these kind of massacres and all the things that we're used to since then. Mm-hmm. But again, having said that, it doesn't mean that the hunter-gatherer lifestyle was a golden age. They were actually healthier for the most part than the people who followed them in agriculture, because they had a wide variety of food that they relied on. But there was also a lot of infant mortality. If times
right.
were tough you had a baby, a lot of time they would just kill the infants because there wasn't enough food to go around. Or if somebody got injured, in an agricultural society, they could be looked after. But in a hunter-gatherer nomadic society, that would probably be the end of their life if they were unable to keep up with the group. So the thing is, we can't just create this kind of sense of an idealized time. And in fact, when hunter-gatherers, who were so much kind of in connection with the natural world, but when they first arrived in new continents like North and South America or Australia, they were actually ended up creating mass extinctions of species, because their tools and their weapons were so much more powerful than the creatures around them. And they created these massive imbalances. And many of the most marvelous, amazing creatures of the earth died out, not because of what we've done recently, but through the activities of early hunter-gatherers.
And then we saw, thousands of years into the agricultural revolution, conquests that became more and more vicious, and the sort of desire for colonialism developed among leaders in various regions of the world. Eventually, you had the sort of the Western conquest of the East that played out over many thousands of years. And we live in a world today where you now say, where you write that now the sort of Western idea of conquest has become globalized, but it wasn't always so. So going back to other very sophisticated civilizations that developed from agricultural societies, like the one centered on China, or the one centered on the Islamic world, how did their cultural mindsets develop with respect to their relationship to the planet and to each other?
Big questions there. And so I think one thing we need to understand is that all agrarian-based societies, whether there's great civilizations, China, Islamic, and other civilizations around the world, and they were all based on the sense of hierarchy, and they all had strong patriarchies, and they all used massive exploitation of other people that they were able to conquer, and of the natural world. So again, we need to be careful.
Are you saying that the pyramids and the Great Wall weren't built by cooperatives?
No, they were built for the most part by slaves, and slavery has been a huge part of our history. One thing that is interesting though is that there is this one ancient civilization that is actually located in kind of northwest India and Pakistan, and called Mohenjo-Daro. It was a civilization that seems to have been the only one that didn't have this kind of incredible hierarchical ranking compared to others. So it doesn't seem that it's absolutely inevitable, but in almost all cases we see that. But the thing that is so interesting is that there was something unique that Western Europe did in their way of thinking about power and exploitation that took this whole notion to a whole other level. They had this view about the world where they were more ready to disrupt whatever equilibrium there was beforehand, and ready to kind of essentially rewrite the rules in order to establish a sort of program of conquest that the world had really never seen before until the 15th century. And that was where, to answer your question, traditional Chinese and Islamic civilizations didn't have the same viewpoint. And until the last 500 years or so, China and Islam were far more advanced than European peoples in terms of their civilization and their power. But in traditional China, the primary focus of the worldview was a sense of harmonizing with each other and with the natural world. And in Islamic society, there was a far bigger driver was to essentially be in touch with the worship of God, rather than try to use technology and try to manipulate the material world in the way that European culture developed.
Now, Jeremy, many offer as a sort of cautionary parable to humanity as a whole as we face climate catastrophe the story of Easter Island, which, is not necessarily something we can blame on Western civilization, an island of a civilization that essentially exploited itself to death, exploited its land to death and extinction in a way. So how does that fit within your story?
Yes, that is so true. And in fact, as I was just touching on before, when we look at all of these great agrarian civilizations, in almost every case, they would exploit their natural resources to the point of just about kind of starvation levels. It's not like they lived in harmony with nature. They would tend to use up their resources in ways that would cause collapse. So Easter Island is this kind of terrifying story, of course, of how a small island got colonized by people who then basically cut down every tree on the island. So there was nothing left for them to...
And they built vast monuments to themselves, these cryptic statues. Yeah.
Which are absolutely terrifying. And when, when they got discovered by the Europeans, and I think it was probably around the 17th century, and all that was left was sort of really like half-starving people, terrified, like living in caves. They really destroyed their own civilization. And that has happened throughout history. So it's not like we in the West are the first peoples to be driving ourselves to this place of imbalance. I think what makes us different from the story of other civilizations in the past are two things. One is that our technology is so powerful now that when we're talking about the risk of collapse, we're not talking about one region that might collapse and then rebuild, but we're talking about our whole global civilization driving to collapse. There's nowhere else to go, basically. And the second thing that makes us different is really a source of hope, is that we're the first civilization who has the ability, through our monitoring of what's going on, to recognize that we are headed in that direction. So whereas other civilizations ended up finding themselves close to collapse without really being able to look at the bigger picture and recognize what was going on, we have that ability. Hmm. And so because of that, we're really the first civilization that has the opportunity to consciously redirect the direction we're going in order to save ourselves from collapse.
Well, there's so many more discussions that we could have on science, on religion, in your book, The Patterning Instinct. But let's come to a close with the idea of how do we change the pattern? How do we reprogram our patterns, if you will, to where the past can teach us how to live sustainably? I mean, most of us are convinced, as we see climate catastrophes unfold around us faster than we ever imagined, but it's the people at the top, the people who are continuing to bank on extractive industries and fossil fuels and expand their power at the expense of humanity's existence, that somehow have to be convinced that our fate as a species lies in the entire, you know, global population of humans changing the way we live.
Yes, I think that's so true. And on top of that, we have this kind of mass media machine, which really essentially is conditioning people. It's almost like hypnotizing people from the earliest years of all of us when we grow up and start watching TV and on the internet, into this kind of consumer lifestyle, which helps to keep the GDP growing and helps to keep corporations profitable and helps to destroy the world at a faster and faster pace. So I think one of the most important things we can all do individually is recognize when these kind of mass consumer-oriented machinery is making us think in certain ways, free ourselves to think in ways that are more in the place of connecting with quality in life and quality in our within our communities. And then I think what we have to do is recognize that it's through the power of connecting together and sharing our values and actually getting involved in the in political engagement that we can make a difference. Because ultimately, those people at the top are only acting in those ways because they feel that they can get away with it. And when there's enough of us recognizing that this is going to drive all of us and future generations to disaster, I think we can really make a difference through that connectivity with each other.
Well, I appreciate your optimism, Jeremy. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And certainly your book has much, much more to offer than what we could fit into this interview. So I do hope people get a hold of it and read it. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Great talking with you, Sonali.
My guest has been Jeremy Lent, writer and founder and president of the Leology Institute. We've been discussing his new book, The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.